From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Hello and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter with Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, investors have been scrambling to find somewhere to park their money where red-hot inflation doesn't erode the value of their holdings. We're going to talk to someone from the world's largest asset manager who has a lot of ideas about that. But first, Valdana, as a preview of my craziest thing of the week, I need to ask you, what is the most you've ever spent on sneakers?
Sneakers?
Tennis shoes, trainers, if you will.
The most. $100 maybe? Not a lot.
$100, yeah. That's
get Keds for like $20.
Keds?
Yeah. Keds.
Do you actually own Keds?
Of course. Taylor Swift owns Keds, so I must own Keds.
And they're only $20. I didn't even know they were still around. That's
I think
awesome.
You can get them for pretty cheap. I mean, they're made of like cotton. They rip very easily.
Huh. You think I could talk my daughters into wearing Keds? Are they
for sure
cool enough?
If they like Taylor Swift, yeah.
As you know, I'm notoriously a cheapskate at heart, but I actually recently spent almost $200 on a pair of running shoes. But it's the kind that comes with, like, you go to one of those running shoe stores and they take a video of your foot and they
scan your foot.
I'm a true believer in it. Look, as you get older, your feet become a bit of a problem. You know, You got your corns and your bunions.
Oh my God,
your pollen arches.
Listeners don't want to know.
I fell for the gimmick, and I'm a true believer in it. I think it has helped my feet, even though I don't really run. The only time I actually run is when I'm late for the train. But I walk a lot. I walk almost like 5 miles a day, you know, to the train, back from the train, up to the snack bar 100 times. You know,
I'm running away from this conversation right now. I'm going to go introduce our guests. Well, I'm so happy that we have Jay Jacobs. He's the U.S. Head of Thematics and Active Equity ETFs at BlackRock. He's joining us this week. I'm thrilled to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us, Jay.
That's a pleasure to be here.
We won't ask you about how much you spent on sneakers just yet.
I'm feeling better after hearing about Mike's $200 purchase. I think I'm closer to you, Valdana.
Oh, thank God. Yeah, I'm so happy to hear that. Anyway, you recently started at BlackRock. I'm sort of hoping we can just start out and you can tell us a little bit about you, your path to BlackRock, and then what your current role entails.
Absolutely. So I've spent my entire career in the ETF industry, which in some ways the industry has been around for a while. It, you know, got its legs in the mid 90s and now is, coming up on 30 years almost. But just in the last 10 years or so, we've seen an explosion of assets in ETFs as people have really seen them as these efficient vehicles for getting exposure to everything from different asset classes to different geographies, and maybe even most recently, different themes and looking at different structural trends that are accelerating around the world and the different baskets of companies that are participating in those themes. So I started very early in my career at the New York Stock Exchange and the ETF listing group there. I moved on to join what was a startup at the time at Global X and helped build out their business. And 3.5 months ago, joined BlackRock as a really exciting transition to join what's a great thematic platform here. We not only have index-based themes where we're tracking targeted baskets of themes like cybersecurity or emergent food and ag tech or robotics, but also actively managed products too, where we tap into the full platform of BlackRock's offering with fundamental equities and BlackRock systematic. So it's a very, very exciting place to be with so much depth of knowledge in the thematic area.
So Jay, what are some of the hot thematic ETFs of the year? I have an inkling as to what they are, considering everything going on in the world. But what are some of the sort of bright spots of the thematics world this year for you?
Well, Mike, I'm sorry to say there's no sneaker ETF yet. We can work on that, but I'm not sure if there's... We'll work on it. At $200, I think that's a pretty good... There's some profits out there to be had.
Well, when you get to my craziest thing, you're going to be blown away with where the sneaker conversation goes. It's absolutely nuts. But you work on that. Get an Air Jordan ETF, and I think the sky's the limit. But
we'll put our best people on it. Within the thematic space, it's been really interesting. You know, over the last 3-4 years, a lot of leadership in the thematic space has been around disruptive technology. It's been looking at things like cloud computing during the pandemic when we were all working from home. It was around genomics and biomedicine when we were trying to figure out the vaccine situation and testing. But now it's really pivoted, especially as we've seen broader shifts within the market from growth to value. People are looking for more themes that are in the value space, especially themes that we think are going to be more resilient amid this high inflationary environment. So we've seen a lot of interest in infrastructure as a theme. Part of that is the Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act and what's happening there. We've seen really an incredible amount of interest in food-related themes, especially as we've seen inflation at the, maybe not so much at Foot Locker, but we're seeing it at the supermarket. And then also we've seen interest in clean energy as a play on inflation, as well as some of the most recent news out of Washington. So we're seeing, again, kind of this shift. It's not just about disruptive tech anymore. We're seeing themes that are playing a little bit more in that value end of the spectrum as investors look for long-term structural trends, but those that can still do well in this different environment than we've been in.
And those different themes, Jay, they're sort of for this inflationary environment, right? So could you maybe walk us through those key themes of yours and why exactly they work in a world like we're having today?
Absolutely. So a lot of it has to do with what are the underlying companies in this theme and why do we think that it's going to benefit in an inflationary environment? So starting with infrastructure, a lot of infrastructure asset owners, you know, companies that run airports, run toll roads, run seaports, or utilities companies, they literally get to change their tolls based off of CPI. So that is a natural built-in business hedge for inflation. When inflation is higher, they get to raise their rates, especially if they're regulated rates tied to CPI. And that just sort of neutralizes those businesses from an inflation perspective. I think what's also happening in that space is you have a lot of money coming into infrastructure from the Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act. So there's a lot of build out of infrastructure that, frankly, these companies don't have to pay for, or they get tax credits or other benefits to build out this infrastructure, which is helping. And then finally, when we think about the economic environment that we're in, infrastructure tends to be very non-cyclical. So if we start to see a recession or if the economy slows down, people still turn on the lights. They still use their ovens. They still pay their water bills. And so not only does it have this inflation component, but there's also a defensive component within this theme, which is kind of giving people that sweet spot of, we don't know if there's a recession, we don't know how long inflation is going to be around, and we also want to participate in long-term structural growth. Inflation really hits on all three of those points. I think the second theme that we are really excited about from that inflation perspective is ag tech and food innovation. And I'll be honest, this is a theme that we thought was really going to be playing out over the next 20 years. We took a step back and we said, the world's arable land is pretty much limited. There's a finite amount of land in the world. If anything, that has been shrinking due to, you know, changes in the climate and more floods and more forest fires, which is making arable land somewhat shrink. But on the demand side of the equation, we've seen a rising emerging market consumer, which is spending more money on food and more complex foods like proteins and dairies. We've seen a growing global population, which will reach 10 billion people by the year 2050. And we're seeing a change in food preferences where people are increasingly demanding sustainable food. So just looking at that, we were believing that over the next several decades, we were going to have this supply and demand imbalance around food that would create food inflation. Of course, that's been pulled forward 20 years earlier than we expected because of conflict in Eastern Europe, which has brought a lot of wheat offline, because of general global supply chain disruptions, which has made it more difficult to ship food around the world. So we're seeing food inflation. We're seeing it in really powerful ways. But we also have these solutions that are already out there with ag tech, like precision farming, precision watering, reduced use of chemicals, more resilient crops. And that is getting accelerated by this environment. And then the third theme is clean energy, where we've seen that a lot of the cost in clean energy is really in the initial build out. You know, you build out a solar farm, you build out a wind turbine. That cost is mostly upfront. Yes, there's some servicing that's ongoing, but a lot of those costs are basically fixed compared to, you know, more traditional forms of energy production where you're constantly paying for fuels. So in an inflationary environment where you have rising commodity prices, upfront payment of a lot of those costs tends to be beneficiary. So those are the three segments where we think really are in the sweet spot of inflation, but also have these long-term tailwinds.
Yeah, Jay, I wonder how often you're sort of studying the headlines out of Washington and trying to figure out what themes could possibly emerge from sort of the shifting politics of DC and really, you know, politics globally, you know, especially the clean energy ETF. Yeah, I'm impressed. It's actually up year to date. So very few things are actually positive year to date. But clean energy, was it ICLN is the ticker, is actually up, I think, 3 or 4% year to date. But how big of a sort of government risk do you see to the clean energy space if, you know, we get to the midterms and there's a all of a sudden the Republicans are controlling Congress and they're not so friendly to clean energy? Does that, you know, sort of political risk play into your thinking very much when deciding to create a thematic ETF like that and B, you know, saying now's a good time to get into it or not?
So with any theme, what we try to look for is what is going to be the catalyst that is the game changer for the theme. So, you know, take any theme. You can take cybersecurity, for example. Cybersecurity technology gets a little bit better each year. Companies spend more money on cybersecurity. But oftentimes you see a catalyst, like a major cyber attack or something that happens in the space that suddenly everyone is thinking about cybersecurity and becomes a transformational moment for the trajectory of that theme. Sometimes it can be a technological advancement. Sometimes it can be new policy and legislation. Sometimes it can be something that's changing in society, like COVID and how much that accelerated certain themes. So earlier in this year, a lot of our focus was what, you know, now that we're past the peak of COVID, what does this mean for things like healthcare? What does this mean for disrupted supply chains? What does this mean for the rising consumer that has continued to become more and more powerful, even amid COVID, like millennials and emerging market consumers? Specifically with clean energy, you know, of course, there's a lot of policy that comes into play as a potential catalyst for this theme. You know, most recently, we've, you know, seen some interesting headlines around the Inflation Reduction Act and specifically targeting about $360 billion that could go to clean energy and electric vehicles. And when you see that amount of money potentially entering the space, that can be a massive catalyst for the trajectory of this theme, specifically because it changes the economics of a theme. So if clean energy becomes cheaper or electric vehicles become cheaper, that accelerates the adoption and that increases the scale of these technologies. As you see scale increase, you tend to see costs come down. That's Wright's Law or the learning curve. And then you start to see really the acceleration of these themes snowball from there. So, you know, absolutely, we look to Washington, but we also look to Silicon Valley, and we also look to, you know, general trends that are happening around society for these catalysts.
So, Jay, Mike mentioned ICLN, which I guess we can pronounce as iClean, yeah?
iClean, absolutely.
And also, you had sent us some notes before we started the podcast about iDRV, iDrive, so some of these ETFs in the clean energy space. And you said that the market is missing a sea change moment. So is that the sea change moment you're referring to? Or can you talk a little bit more about that when it comes to these specific, you know, ETFs in this space?
Absolutely. So what we're seeing is really the economics of these different themes shifting because of this potential policy that, you know, that could be passed, right? So if we look at electric vehicles, for example, right now, your average cost of the average purchase price of an electric vehicle is about 22% higher than the average purchase price of all cars in the United States. So it's about a fifth to a quarter higher. But actually, when you look under the hood, you see, no pun intended, if you actually look under the hood of these cars, the total cost of ownership over the lifespan of the car is already cheaper for electric vehicles. That's because it's cheaper to fuel up and it's cheaper to maintain. I was just doing some back of the napkin math. It's about $10 to fuel up about 300 miles of range in an electric vehicle. It's about $40 to $50 nationally right now to fuel up a similar internal combustion engine. So you can think about every time you fill it up, it's a little bit cheaper with electric vehicles. That helps to close the price gap. When you add on top of that incentives from the government, which could be as high as $7,500 for a new electric vehicle, then the economics will really start to get more attractive to consumers. And it becomes it no longer becomes a question of, you know, do you like one car more than the other? I think the most powerful driver in a lot of these things is just purely economics. And if there's a cheaper car off the lot or a similar priced car off the lot, but you're filling up for $10 instead of $40 to $50, that's a really compelling argument for a lot of consumers. So when we see policy come through that can help change those economics to be more attractive to a specific theme, we see that as a very powerful accelerant.
Vildad, I'm going to call Jay out on that. I think that under the hood pun was actually intended.
You're right. I'm sorry.
It was really good. It was so good.
I can't let that slip.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com. The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Speaking of under the hood, Jay, I was looking at some of the stocks in the IDRV, the self-driving and EV ETF. I'm curious how a few of these fit into the theme. I mean, obviously Tesla's in there. That's clear enough. Bunch of chip makers, Qualcomm, NVIDIA, Intel, Eaton, the engine maker, fine. But Apple, Alphabet, and Samsung. And maybe I just haven't been paying close enough attention, but how do those companies fit into a self-driving theme? I'm assuming it's just they must have ambitions somewhere along the line to somehow be involved in this space to some degree.
A lot of the big tech players are investing very heavily in autonomous vehicles. And a lot of it is that part of this is it's a brute force equation to try to figure out autonomous vehicles. There's a lot of processing power and a lot of data that needs to be collected to be able to figure out something like a unprotected left-hand turn, which sounds simple. But when you do it in a car, it's hard for me. And a computer has to take in a lot of inputs to figure out how to do that safely. So who's really the best position to take in all of that data, to process that data, to apply artificial intelligence? Well, no surprise, it's a lot of the companies that lead in data collection and artificial intelligence. So we've seen, you know, major players in big tech coming into this space. You know, maybe it's kind of pre-revenue, but they are behind the scenes developing some very powerful products going forward. I think the bigger point is when we look at thematic investing, we're really trying to understand the entire ecosystem of who benefits from this theme. So I'm sure many listeners can name a couple car companies off the top of their head that are powerful electric vehicle companies. But looking across the ecosystem, you know, who are the companies that are building the batteries that go into those electric vehicles? Who are the companies supplying those battery manufacturers with lithium and other critical metals that go into batteries? Who are the AV developers? Who are the parts suppliers? Because the parts suppliers in the electric vehicle space are very different than internal combustion engines. There's very different parts that are required in those two vehicles. So in thematic investing, a lot of the research that goes into these funds is really happening upfront, trying to understand what is the state of the world and what are the subsectors and sub-industries that are really going to benefit if we see this theme really materialize. So last year was actually already a transformational year for electric vehicles. About 10% of cars sold around the world were electric. We were a little bit further behind in the United States, but we expect that gap will close. Again, because of the economic argument, we have higher gas prices. We have more models that are coming into the space in electric vehicles. We have prices generally falling in electric vehicles. And now we might have another tax credit, which makes the economics even more attractive.
And Jay, when you're talking to clients and you're talking about the other two categories that you mentioned, so agriculture and infrastructure, what are some of the ETFs that you're focusing on when it comes to those two themes?
Absolutely. So in the infrastructure space, it's IFRA. I'm a big fan of ticker pronunciation as well. So IFRA, we pronounce IFRA. It's our U.S. infrastructure fund. So we're looking not only at traditional infrastructure owners, the companies that kind of own and operate infrastructure around the United States, but also the companies that are building infrastructure of the future and the inputs that go into building the infrastructure of the future. Part of that is due to the Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act and the $1.2 trillion that's going into infrastructure around the United States. Part of that is increased investment from the private side, from states, from local municipalities. Basically, there is a lot of investment coming into infrastructure, which had largely been neglected over the last several decades in this country. And, you know, there's a great report that comes out every 4 years, the American Society of Civil Engineers, and they gave the US a D+ on infrastructure. So we knew this was coming. We knew there was going to be a need for a lot more investment. We don't just want to own the existing asset owners, but also who are building the new airports and the new seaports and the new 6-lane highways going through the country. And then on the food side of things, our ticker is IVEG, I-V-E-G, which is our emergent food and ag tech multi-sector ETF. And that's really looking at who are the innovators within food. I did a kind of a fun test within the office. I bought two types of strawberries, traditional strawberries and my fancy new age strawberries. And a traditional strawberry is grown about 2,500 miles away from New York City, oftentimes grown in California. Oftentimes, it can use as much as 300 times the weight of the strawberry in water. It could have up to 8 pesticides being used in that strawberry. And of course, it has to be transported across the country so that we can enjoy it, in New York City. My special fancy strawberry that I also brought in is grown in Jersey City, so about 100 times closer, in an indoor vertical farm. It can be grown year-round. It uses about 95% less water. Oftentimes, it can use no pesticides at all because it's grown inside and there's less risk of pests coming in and eating the crops. And the cherry on top of this strawberry is that a robot can actually analyze the strawberry when it's growing and perfectly optimize the time to harvest for its juiciest, most flavorful moment. So we did a little taste test in the office with these two different kinds of strawberries, and naturally people gravitated towards our delicious hand robot picked indoor vertically farmed strawberry. But the point is to show that ag tech can have a really powerful implication on how we grow our crops and where we get it from and what are the inputs into those crops. And, you know, going back to inflation, we're seeing inflation in labor costs, we're seeing inflation in chemicals, we're seeing inflation in water prices. So if you look at all those different inputs and you can replace them or reduce their usage through ag tech, you can start to fight inflation. And so, you know, right now, some of these technologies are a little bit nascent, but as we see more adoption and more scale, we believe that will drive down costs of food going forward.
I had not heard of these fancy Jersey City strawberries. That's pretty cool. They tasted better because they're grown in Jersey City. They actually taste like pork roll, Valdana. That's the secret.
Yeah. I actually have heard of them. My only fear is that the fancy strawberries cost like $40 per strawberry or something.
No, it's not that high, but it's expensive. These are, when you look at the trajectory of nascent technologies, they often start expensive. and you need to attack the early adopters. And so think about the EV industry. What was the strategy? Go for the fancy luxury car market. These are the people that are going to have more disposable income to spend on a fancy EV. Go for tax credits. Lobby in Washington to get more money to bring down the costs. As you start to see that scale, then you can start building cars for the masses. And I think we're going to see a similar trajectory in ag tech. Right now, we have fancy, somewhat expensive strawberries. But as this technology scales, costs will come down. And soon, all of our strawberries, maybe, will be grown in Jersey City in an indoor warehouse.
But Jay, it's really a fascinating concept of thematic ETFs. And, you know, we were joking about, you know, Air Jordan sneaker ETF, but I can only imagine your team at BlackRock sitting around and the ideas, you know, there must be a million ideas a day about a new theme, you know, especially over the past few years. You know, we went from the trade war with China to COVID to energy, inflation, you know, the food shortage. You know, it's just been a banner few years for potential thematic ways to invest. So I'm just curious about the process at BlackRock. You know, am I right to think of you, you know, y'all battering around about 100 different ideas every time you get together? And how do you sort of winnow it down to one that you actually want to launch? And to make this a 12-part question, you know, is there sort of a number in your mind of how many new ones per year or per quarter that you'd want to limit your launches to, and sort of what is the process of going from drawing board to bringing a thematic ETF to the market?
It's a great question. And the opportunities in some sense are unlimited. As you said, you know, themes are constantly evolving. New themes are emerging from nowhere. Other themes are sunsetting, you know, as they kind of grow into mature industries. And so it's a constantly evolving space. And I think that really proved out in the last few years. We saw assets in thematic ETFs quintuple from 2019 to 2021, as people increasingly saw these new ways of slicing and dicing the market as really trying to align their ideas with investments. Again, going back to the pandemic, it wasn't enough to just look for a tech sector ETF. People really specifically wanted to look for, where am I spending my money? I'm spending it online. Where am I spending my time? I'm spending it on video games and e-commerce. And how am I working? I'm working remotely through cloud computing. People really wanted these more refined exposures that got a little bit deeper than, you know, more traditional sector ETFs. But when we think about the process of themes, we have to apply a rigid structure to it so we don't get lost in this infinite possibilities space. And really, we're looking for a few different things. First of all, we really want to develop our conviction behind a theme. So we have five different categories of megatrends within BlackRock. We're looking at breakthrough technologies. We're looking at climate change and resource scarcity. We're looking at changing demographics. We're looking at the emerging consumer. And we're looking at urbanization. And so oftentimes, we're looking within and across those buckets of where are we seeing powerful trends. And the more a trend aligns with one of those buckets, the more conviction we have behind it. But we'll dig in. We want to find out if this is a new technology, how good is this technology? Are people using it? How big is the market for this technology going forward? Are there other technologies that need to emerge with this technology for it to be viable or profitable? And so we really dig in and research this, not just within iShares, but within our partners across BlackRock to really understand what is the opportunity set in this theme. And do we believe that this theme is going to have a powerful impact on the world around us? The second thing we have to look at, though, is it also investable? Can we get good exposure to this theme in an ETF? And ETFs can only invest in public equities. We can invest globally, so we can look anywhere around the world within any sector, within any geography for this opportunity. But we still need to find those companies that are really leading in this space. And so some themes are interesting. They might have this, you know, incredibly large total addressable market. But if we can't invest in it, we're not going to bring it out as a theme. And then really the third thing we look at is time horizon. We want these themes not to be over tomorrow. That's going to be too fast. We don't want them to start taking off 100 years from now because we don't have the patience for that either. There's a sweet spot in thematic investing, which is that we anticipate that a catalyst can happen in the next 3 to 5 years and that the expression of this theme will happen over the next decade or so. That is the sweet spot from a time horizon perspective. So, Mike, to some extent, you're right. We do get to sit around and think about some, you know, off the wall ideas. But when we put it through this rigid process, that's what narrows it down to, you know, the handful of themes that we launch each year.
So can you tell us which themes or trends are on your radar right now? And I sort of imagine you guys have a little list of things that are interesting to you, or that you think will, you know, check off all of the boxes for the things you just mentioned. I remember talking to an issuer a couple of years ago who had said, you know, clean energy, or sorry, water use was going to be a theme that they had been looking at. Obviously, crypto has been a very hot, or I don't even know how to describe it anymore, but it's caught a lot of people's attentions, a lot of issuers' attention over the last couple of months. And feel free to share as much proprietary BlackRock internal information as you want.
I was going to say, as much as I would love to share, this is like the recipe to Diet Coke or something. It's under like triple secret lock, a lot of these ideas. But
this is your chance. Yeah. This is your chance to really open up.
At least give us the worst theme idea you've ever heard. Maybe it was the Air Jordan idea. I don't know.
I like that theme. Let's play with that a little bit, Mike. Like, so I'm serious, like the sneaker theme. So what is it really representing? There is a new consumer. There's this rising millennial consumer and this rising emerging market consumer that is finding that they have more money than they've had previously because they are increasingly entering the workforce. They're rising up the ranks of their companies and they have to decide where they want to spend their money. And what's interesting about this consumer group is that they are more likely to spend money on sneakers than previous generations. So, you know, I don't know if a sneaker ETF is really viable, but there are mega trends within that. You know, if you broaden that out, there's a mega trend behind that, which is what is the new consumer and how are they spending their money differently from other generations? And so part of that, you know, is related to blockchain. We see that there's a lot of people in the emerging markets who have been unbanked in the past and can suddenly access finance through blockchain and decentralized finance. Part of that is through food. Millennials are much more likely to prefer food from sustainable sources than other generations. And so the food that they demand it looks different than the food that previous generations have demanded. And that's why we see alternative proteins and alternative dairies showing up on, you know, on all the aisles in our supermarkets. So there is a theme behind sneakers, Mike. And it's a powerful one. It's one that we certainly have our eyes on. I'm not going to promise a sneaker ETF, but the changing consumer is a very powerful megatrend.
Absolutely.
And what were some of those themes you were just about to share with us? Those ones.
I thought I wiggled out of that one. You'll have to invite me back and I can share. We have exciting themes under development, but I'll have to come back and share them when they're ready for the public.
And Jay, I assume ESG must play a pretty significant input in how you're thinking about these, just given BlackRock's sort of emphasis on ESG and also just the investing public. You know, I'm trying to think who your target buyer of a thematic ETF would be. Is it individuals? Is it pensions? You know, institutions? And how big of a sort of impetus are ESG considerations when looking at themes?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, one of our megatrend pillars is climate and resource scarcity. So when we look at some of the powerful trends happening around the world today, some of them are very much related to climate. We've already talked about it with food and, you know, how we're seeing kind of shrinkage of arable land. When it comes to clean energy, we're seeing the powerful forces within policy and consumer demand that are powering greater growth in clean energy production. So that's an entire pillar of our megatrends framework. But to your question around who's the buyer of thematic, it really runs a wide gamut. And I think part of that is that on one hand, these are very approachable ideas that people can intuitively understand. So a novice investor can wrap their head around an idea like, I see a lot of electric vehicles on the road. Is this a growing theme? How do I get exposure to it? Oh, there's an iDrive ETF. But on the other hand, these are sophisticated concepts. These are providing exposures that are crossing geographies, crossing sectors, providing really unique exposures to a portfolio. And we see even institutions using them in their portfolios to get these unique cuts and these unique exposures in a broader, more diversified portfolio. So there's a very wide buyer base of these themes. It really can't be pigeonholed to just one type of investor.
And I have one more question for you about sort of the internal dealings of how you guys come up with different funds. One thing that's super interesting to me is tickers. And we've mentioned a bunch of really great ones that you guys have. There's some really, really catchy ones where when you see the ticker, you definitely know what you can expect from the ETF. So how important is it to have I don't know if catchy is the best word. Maybe you have a better word to use in this case, but how important is it to have a very good ticker where somebody can easily find you or sort of get enticed by the ticker itself to even become interested in the ETF?
I think it helps a ton. I mean, people have a strong memory for tickers. And so I guess backing up very early in my career, my very first job at the New York Stock Exchange was actually reserving tickers for ETF issuers. That's the part of the job. So it's kind of like being I assume it's like being the person at the DMV that does vanity license plates, but you're only working with up to four characters. So you're a little bit more limited, but I love a great ticker. I'm as much of a fan as you. Having a good memorable ticker, I think means a lot. I mean, at iShares, we have a very kind of common approach where we'll use I for the I in iShares. And then we have three letters at our disposal to do something memorable. So when we think about, you know, emergent food, we have iVeg. When we think about electric vehicles, we have iDrive. For cybersecurity, iHack. And so we try to take both that kind of familiarity of using the I, but then also having something that really links the ticker to the theme. But I love a good ticker.
And are you sort of compiling lists and then going to the exchanges and reserving them just in case you want to come up with a fund down the line?
Oh, no. We try to tie it to product launches specifically. So we think, you know, we get people in the room and think through the different ticker ideas as we're getting ready for a product launch.
Yeah. SNKR is available, Jay. I've just thrown it out there. You know,
maybe ISNK, iSneak.
There you go. iSneak. So, Jay, how about in fixed income? I mean, I know iShares is obviously famous for the TLT, the HYG, you know, the big treasury and high yield bond ETFs. Is there space in thematics for fixed income from your perspective?
We haven't seen much of it yet, but we're seeing growing adoption of themes. Themes are really just different ways to slice and dice the market to get exposure to forward-looking ideas. And so for the most part, we've seen a lot of that focused on the equity space because you can get really targeted exposures through equities and you can get a lot of, we call it kind of theme beta. It's a little bit of a nerdy term for how much exposure are you getting to of a theme. So if robotics takes off, if robotics in the real economy is taking off, are we seeing, you know, the robotic stocks taking off as well? You could apply that to fixed income. We haven't done much in that space, yet. But I think the breadth of opportunity of thematic is expanding very rapidly, and I would expect to see a lot more product innovation and across assets, across themes, across geographies going forward.
And Jay, obviously we have so many different ETFs. I forget what the number is now. It's probably over 2,000. You probably know the number off the top of your head, just in the ETF, in the entire ETF universe. I'm just wondering if you ever think about the space being overly saturated or if we can get to a point where there's just so many options out there for people, too many.
I think choice is an incredible thing for investors because it lets people express their opinions through ETFs using really refined exposures that align with their views. So I'll give you a little bit of an example. Within the robotics space in the ETF industry, there's about five different robotics ETFs. The average overlap between those products is less than 20%. So even though all the products are looking at robots, we're all looking at robots a little bit differently, whether that's BlackRock views on robotics or someone else. And so that gives investors a lot of choice. I think that gives investors also need to have a lot of trust in the issuer behind that ETF of how they've designed the exposure to that specific theme. But we think that choice is wonderful for investors to be able to really look again under the hood. I'm sorry for the pun. I guess it doesn't apply to robots, but look under the hood at an EV ETF and understand what is the exposure and is that really the exposure they're looking for.
Yeah, I imagine there's a little bit of Darwinism at play too. You know, if the thing's not gathering enough assets to make it sustainable, then it goes into retirement or the ETF graveyard, as Balchunas would call it. But speaking of Balchunas, Jay, I'm sure you've run into him at some point. He's our ETF guru here, Eric Balchunas at Bloomberg. He tweeted something the other day that I found pretty interesting. Shouldn't be that surprising, I guess, but it was basically a bar chart of assets in ETFs sorted by what their expense ratios are, you know, and obviously the lower the expense ratio, the higher the assets. And I wonder how you think about that in thematics. It's, you know, I'm looking at, say, for example, the IDRV expense ratio of 47 basis points, which is not a huge expense ratio. But when you compare it to, say, you know, a NASDAQ 100 or an S&P, one of those really competitive spaces for index ETFs, they get down into these minuscule expense ratios. So how hard is it to cut those expenses on a thematic, even if it's not an active one? I mean, even a passive one, there's this whole process and research that goes into it. How big of a deal is the expense ratio in thematics? And do you think, you know, I'm assuming there's always an effort to bring it down. You know, how do you go about that process?
Yeah, so a lot of it comes down to portfolio construction. So, you know, many investors will do more of a core satellite approach where they will have the lion's share of their assets in very, you know, low cost diversified core products and, you know, get the S&P 500 tracking and their fixed income and really cover, you know, wide swaths of the market with that low cost exposure. And then they'll supplement that with smaller satellite positions that can give them more growth or give them more income or give them more risk management. And that's where it's going to be kind of smaller allocations, but really help them to achieve their outcomes. So oftentimes we'll see, you know, three or four thematic ETFs put into the satellite portion of one's portfolio. Maybe it's 10% or 15% of their portfolio, but it's giving them that growth opportunity that is enhanced above the core. Because that tends to be a smaller allocation, you know, the funds are going to be smaller in size than core funds. You know, we haven't seen a thematic ETF reach $100 billion in assets yet. They often tend to be smaller than that, and that, you know, sort of justifies the fees in terms of scale. But oftentimes, you can still achieve a very low cost diversified portfolio with thematic with all in fees that are very low. So we think that we're continuing to provide a lot of value to investors with the pricing of both our themes and the core.
Yeah, what is the biggest? The clean energy ones, like $5 billion or something.
That is, yep, that is one of the biggest on our platform. Absolutely.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com. The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Jay, good stuff. We got to send Valdana over to get some of those Jersey City strawberries that taste like pork roll or Taylor
I would love to try. Yeah, pork roll.
They taste like delicious strawberries.
All right. Well, that's
like indoor Jersey City strawberries, Mike.
That's less exciting. That's less innovative than I was hoping for in these Jersey City strawberries. But I, as the Garden State, I'm sure they're good. But I think it's that time, Valdana. Do you know what time it is?
Well, this strawberry thing is pretty crazy, but I think it's time for us to also play craziest thing we saw in markets.
Okay.
Weirdest absolutely. Thing, craziest thing.
Crazy.
Whatever we call it.
Still crazy, still craziest thing after all these years. You go first. Yeah. I've got high hopes for your crazy thing this week.
Mine is so good, but it's so good that you actually might have heard of it already. Yeah. And it made me a little bit queasy, which is why I'm going with it.
Queasy.
Queasy. You'll see.
Worse than the how many rats can be found in a dollar store warehouse?
You tell me.
All right.
Fancy Feast is opening a pop-up Italian restaurant in New York City with, quote, upscale dishes that are inspired by its canned cat food. It's launching this month in downtown New York City. I actually think it starts next week. I would love to actually just maybe go and scope this out. So It's branded Gatto Bianco, which means white cat. And they're going to be serving dishes like salmon pomerodini. Not pronouncing this very well, but salmon with cherry tomatoes. And brasato di manzo, which is beef short ribs in red wine. And you can have lemon panna cotta for dessert.
I mean, it actually sounds delicious. I don't know why they felt inclined to make the connection to cat food in this, you know, I don't know. Can you bring your cat to the restaurant?
I don't think so. I mean, cats are antisocial. They don't want to be going out for dinner. But it doesn't make you queasy?
Well, when you say the names of the dishes, it makes me very hungry. But when I think fancy feasts, I do get a little queasy. I wonder, you're a cat person. Is this like something cat people will embrace?
No way.
Dog lovers are going nowhere near this place. I'll tell you that.
No, I don't know who's going near this place. I would love to honestly just see what it looks like. But when I feed my cat and I open it and a little bit of the stuff gets on my hand, I literally, it's like a nuclear waste, like touching my skin.
The last thing you're thinking is, ooh, give me some of that on a plate.
Yeah, exactly.
That was pretty good. I did see that one, but I will I'll give you mad respect, as the kids say, for bringing that one up. It's a good one. How about you, Jay? You see anything crazy in the markets recently?
I'm going to stick with strawberries over cat food. I just want to make that clear. I'm all for food innovation, but that's a step too far for me. I'll stick with the food theme. I think this is crazy as far as finance nerds get, but I was looking into inflation a bit. The cost of a dozen eggs has gone up 65% in the last year. Wow. It took 20 years to have the same amount of inflation in eggs before that. So from 2000 to 2020 was the same increase. I think that's crazy. And that, you know, a lot of what we've talked about today with food inflation and, you know, the bill when you leave the supermarket and some of the sticker shock on that, it's pretty wild to see that amount of increase in such a short time.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder if it's the input cost, the chicken feed, literally, that's doing it probably, right? But that is nuts. All right. I promised you something related to sneakers, and our colleague Miss Lorena had a really amazing story out. Vildana, you probably read it, but it's about an Air Jordan Ponzi scheme. I believe that the first of its kind. And it all goes back to this StockX. I think this was one of my crazy things from a few years ago, but there's this exchange basically for sneakers, mainly Air Jordans, but I guess, you know, plenty of others trade on it too.
And Keds, maybe.
Keds. I don't know about Keds. I don't know.
I'm kidding. Keds.
I'm going to talk my kids into getting Keds. But this story is nuts because the details of this Ponzi scheme, basically this couple was promising rare Air Jordans at, you know, way below what the market price was. But it was a Ponzi. People would send him their money. They wouldn't get the sneakers. Maybe they'd complain and he'd send them some money back. But, there were some fraudulent bank loans involved. It's a big mess. But it got me poking around on the site of StockX. And believe it or not, StockX has Air Jordan indexes. There's an Air Jordan 4. I guess the fourth version of the Air Jordan was a very popular one. And there's a Nike Air Max 1 index. They also have you ever heard of Kaws? Either one of you hear of K-A-W-S figurines? I'd never heard of this. It's some graffiti artist who started making these little funny figurines. And they're a hot thing now among collectors, I guess. And also a basketball trading cards index. Basketball cards are a big thing. So I found this report on their website, and they track the appreciation of each of these indexes from beginning of 2020 till the end of April 2021. So that is the golden era of crazy market action right there. Beginning of 2020 to April, end of April 2021. So, Jay, I regret to inform you, you are now a contestant on The Price. What did we decide the name of the show was?
The Price is Correct.
The price is correct, yes.
We can't call it Price is Right.
Yes, we do not want to get
it's correct
sued or punched by Bob Barker like Happy Gilmore. Yeah. The price is accurate. No, I like the price is correct. The price is correct. All right. So beginning of 2020 to the end of April 2021, we're going to chart the Air Jordan 4 Index, the Nike Air Max 1 Index, the Cause Figurine Index, the Basketball Trading Card Index, and a quaint little index known as the S&P 500. What do you think performed the best, and what was the return?
I'm going to go with this Air Jordan 4 Index, and I'll say it was up 1,200%.
1,200%, okay.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to keep my poker face on. As a reminder, Jay, we've got the Air Jordan 4 Index, the Nike Air Max 1 Index, the Cause Figures Index, and the Basketball Trading Cards Index, and the S&P 500. What do you think performed the best from the beginning of 2020 till the end of April 2021? And that's the time frame in their report. That's the only reason. I don't have the actual data to play around with.
I have never heard of Cause. I'm going to go with basketball cards. I think basketball has really entered the zeitgeist and people are tracking it really closely. And I'm going to go with basketball cards. I'm going to say a 10x, 1,000%.
10x. Okay. Deltada, once again, I regret to inform you, you've lost. The price is accurate this week.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked. Considering all my deep knowledge of weird sneakers.
Jay got it on the head. The Basketball Trading Card Index, little frothy on your returns there. It was 200% return, but still pretty good. I mean, for basketball cards, who knew? The S&P, for comparison, was only up about 29% over that time. Air Jordan 4 Index up 100. Cause beat the Nike Air Max 1s. Cause still beat the S&P over that period, for whatever the heck they are.
Naturally, yeah. That makes sense.
That's the world we live in that some stupid thing none of us have even heard of, some silly little toys beat the S&P 500 over that period. Thankfully, Jay, I don't know. Have the markets come back to earth? Are they sane again, do you think? Or how are you thinking overall about the sort of the insanity of the markets now compared to what we saw the previous 2 years?
I think we found our footing. There's been a bit of a shakeout. I think the shift from growth to value has helped people recalibrate their portfolios. I think there's still going to be more volatility. We're still trying to digest what, you know, living with inflation looks like for a longer period of time, what shortages mean in the economy as well. But it seems like the markets have found their footing a bit. So a little bit more driven by fundamentals than maybe it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that sounds about right to me. And just for your own notes, Jay, Cause, K-A-W-S, that ticker's available too. You know, just throwing it out there.
We'll take a look into it, yeah.
I Cause.
For good cause. Cows. Maybe it's cows. I don't know. Moo. What's the Moo ETF?
There's a Moo ETF, yeah. Cash cow.
Cash cow. It's so a scam, good. Though. It has nothing to do with
so
cows.
So good.
It's all cows.
I love it.
Anyway, with that said, Jay, fascinating conversation. We really appreciate your time, and I hope we can have you back again to hear what's new with thematics at BlackRock in the future.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jay.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heirich is at Vildana Heirich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Stacey Wong. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor, QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com. The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.